This program is brought to you by Chefs Collaborative, a nonprofit with a mission to inspire, educate, and celebrate chefs and food professionals building a better food system. Change menus, change lives. Learn more at chefscollaborative.org.
Thank you for listening to Heritage Radio Network. We are a member-supported nonprofit food radio station. That means that every single thing we do, from broadcasting 35 weekly shows for free, to bringing you exclusive content from sold-out food events across the country, to offering scholarships to high school students, is only possible thanks to the support of our loyal members. And we want you to join the club. Become a member during our 2017 summer drive to get access to sweet swag and pledge your support to the world's only food radio station. Visit heritageradionetwork.org/donate to become a member now.
Welcome to The Line here on Heritage Radio. Today, I'm excited to welcome Scott Conant to the program. Many people know him because he has appeared on TV many times. He's been a judge on Chopped, Top Chef. He's been on dozens of episodes of cooking programs. But today, we're really going to talk about his cooking pedigree and the history of his cooking career in New York and beyond. He's received 3 stars from the New York Times for L'Impero and Scarpetta, 4 stars from the Miami Herald for Scarpetta Miami, Best New Restaurant 2003 from the James Beard Foundation, and he was a Best New Chef from Food & Wine magazine in 2004. He cooks a lot of Italian food. We're going to talk about that and his childhood growing up in Waterbury, Connecticut. Scott, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thanks for having my childhood in Waterbury, Connecticut.
Let's start at the way beginning. So Waterbury is pretty close to New York. It's about 90 or so minutes outside. I'm curious, did you spend time coming into the city eating? Where did the passion for food come from at the beginning of your life?
Well, I was a chubby kid. So I think that was my main motivator. Main motivation was just getting as much food in my belly as possible, and that hasn't changed, which is the good news. No, my father grew up on a farm in the north of Maine, so it was a potato farm. So, you know, they had animals and potatoes essentially, and so there was always that respect for the land, so to speak, and definitely a respect for what was on the table. And my mother, her parents were Italian. So there was always that, you know, again, that traditional Italian-American tabletop that we grew up with, and Sundays at my grandparents, and this memory of my grandmother with this big wooden board rolling out pasta and things like that.
So did you actually, did a lot of your pasta technique that you utilize in your restaurants, was any of it from grandma, or did you just kind of see it and then you went on to kind of learn your own style?
I went on to learn my own style. You know, I spent a long time later in life working at San Domenico on Central Park South, which is now Morea, and then traveling through Italy and things like that. So my grandmother passed when I was young, but all my mother's aunts and my cousins and things like that definitely inspired.
You got a food job really early in life. You were working at this restaurant. Do you remember the name of the first spot where you were washing dishes?
The Sea Loft in Waterbury.
And what type of place was that? And were you was it a money job? Was it to meet girls? Like what was the impetus for starting to work at such a young age?
The main impetus in the beginning was to buy a car by the time I was 16.
Okay.
So I wanted to be able to save a little bit of money.
Good goal, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that's, you know, seems normal. But I'll never forget walking into that kitchen for the first time. And I went to a vocational school simultaneously. So as I got this job at this restaurant, I also couldn't get into the plumbing program of the vocational school that I went to. So as a second choice, I chose culinary arts. It was the only thing that I was good at besides gym, you know? So it was the only class that I'd honestly gotten an A in besides gym. So I just started working, and I'll never forget walking into that kitchen for the first time. I played a lot of baseball as a kid, and that sense of team and that camaraderie was important to me because, you know, it was kind of all for one, one for all, you know? And that's a similar feeling that I had walking into a professional kitchen.
I'm curious about the hours. You know, you were putting in pretty long weeks there, I read. Yeah. And so you're going to this Caner vocational school mm-hmm. where you're taking these culinary classes, right? And then, but you're also working. Did your parents support that decision? Did it seem crazy or normal at the time to be having basically like a full-time job as a 14-year-old?
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I never thought about it. You're a kid. You just do what's in front of you. Mm-hmm. You know, you put your head down. I put my head down. I've always been one of those people. But now as I speak to my mother, I think they were just happy I wasn't out on the streets, you know, roaming around, mm-hmm. doing drugs, acting like a jackass. You know, I think that was the main thing for them. They knew where I was every night.
So it gave you not only camaraderie, but it gave you kind of a structure to build off of. I'm curious about when did you make the decision to go to culinary school formally? And what was that experience like? You went to the CIA, right?
I went to CIA. Well, you know, it was interesting because I'm not from a family where continued education is necessarily a thing. I was really, I think, the only person in my immediate family to go to school after high school. Mm-hmm. Definitely on my father's side. None of my cousins really went.
What's
to,
your
went
dad
to,
do?
My father was a machinist, a tool maker. So okay. he worked in a shop, you know, in making.
Worked
with his hands. Yeah. He built machines that would make the tips of erasers, you know, that the erasers hold in a pencil. So things like that. I mean, really very middle class. And that's what Waterbury is, a very middle class town with a lot of shops and now a lot of abandoned factories. So this idea of working in a kitchen for my parents was like, what are you doing? Like, what do you mean? Like, there were no fancy restaurants that we were familiar with. So they thought I was going to be flipping burgers until I was, you know, retired.
But the CIA is definitely, well, now more so, but it's definitely sort of one of the most fancy and most prestigious culinary schools. It has a lot of French tradition and technique infused to it. So was that a big wake-up call for you, the toques and the early wake-up times? Really rigorous, right?
It was rigorous, but you know, it was something. It was nothing that I hadn't done before, in the sense where after I'd worked at the Sea Loft, I went to go work at a hotel with a bunch of CIA grads, and they were tough on me. You know, they saw my potential and they were tough, but also there was one guy, I'll never forget it. He was a CIA grad, a guy named Ron Pascow. And he said to me, you know, you can't move to New York. You're not good enough. You're not good enough to live in New York City. So I found that to be wildly offensive, but also a huge motivator.
he challenged you and you kept it in the back of your mind. And so how long did you spend at CIA? You were at Hyde Park?
I was in Hyde Park, and that was before there was a four-year program. So it was a two-year program that I did there.
And did you end up coming straight to New York?
I did my externship here, and I did it at San Domenico. And that was the first time that I'd seen Italian food at that level. I was just accustomed to the things that I grew up with, or the things in the local restaurants in Waterbury. So
can you kind of give us a snapshot of, you know, at that, obviously high-end Italian food is very present now in New York City, but at that time, are you kind of saying that there was only like mom and pop red sauce joints and had you not experienced a fancy Italian meal before you started working at San Domenico?
That's right. Okay. Never. No. And frankly, they didn't exist that much. Okay. There was basically in New York City, there was Falidia. Which has its rusticity, you know, it has a rustic element at Falidia, but San Domenico was super high end. Mm-hmm. You know, it's hard to describe exactly how fancy that restaurant was, but it was fancy and pretentious. I remember they actually asked JFK Jr. to leave one night because he walked in without a jacket. So that's
pretty serious.
That's pretty serious. I mean, it was JFK Jr. and he was with Daryl Hannah and he couldn't sit down.
Wow. If it's the Marais space, that's at 59th, right?
59th Circle. Central Park South.
Okay.
Exactly.
So that's pretty far from Waterbury.
Yeah.
So where are you living at that time? You're taking the train to Central Park every day. You're getting off. It's a soup crowd. What are you doing?
I actually somehow finagled an apartment inside that building where San Domenico is at 240 Central Park South.
Swanky.
And I paid for it. I mean, we somehow had three of us, four of us inside a studio apartment that we that we all lived there. It was disgusting. But we worked. I mean, we were working 90, 100 hours a week.
All food guys in the apartment?
All food guys.
And at a very young age, at 24, you become CDC at, is it Il Toscanaccio?
Il Toscanaccio,
Okay.
That was a Pinot Longo restaurant, yeah.
And so that's pretty young. Were you ready?
No.
What's that moment no. like when you get tapped, when you're CDC, you're 24, and you're... I mean, are you faking it?
I mean, yeah, there was a lot of faking
it.
What
does it feel like?
There was a lot of, you know, I've never been afraid to ask questions.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a lot of questions being asked. But also at the time, there was a lot of direction coming from up above. Cesare Casella was the executive chef of Coco Pazzo and Toscanaccio. And Cesare had a very different style of cooking than what I was accustomed to from my San Domenico days. It was much more rustic. There were a lot of herbs and deep fried herbs and all this kind of stuff that we didn't even have a deep fryer at San Domenico. So just to show you the differential, you know,
mm-hmm.
We had all our pastas being made in here. We were using a lot of dry pasta at Toscanaccio. So there was a big change for me, but the good news was it taught me a different style. It taught me that balance of rustic and, you know, the two schools of Italian kitchen, La Cucina Rustica and the Alta Cucina. So really that's where the balance started for me.
Who's helping you navigate these waters? I mean, there's so many things to do as a CDC besides just working service. It goes so beyond that. Mm. And as someone who was in a kitchen with perhaps people that were much older than you and maybe had been at the restaurant for longer, I'm curious, how did you have someone outside of the restaurant that you could look to for advice? Did you have either a peer or someone around your age that was in the same position as you at all?
You know, I wish that I did, you know, and now you're saying it makes a lot of sense to have had that person. I didn't have that person. I've really never had that person to help me with those directions in my life other than lawyers throughout my career, which tend to be very expensive.
And not always looking out for anyone else.
Exactly.
So I want to just sidestep for a minute. You mentioned dry pasta versus making pasta in-house. This is something that I'm always curious about because I feel, and I'd love for you to explore this deeper, there are certain styles of pasta mm-hmm. which are totally acceptable to have be dry, right? And then there are certain styles of pasta that you want to make daily. Can you talk a little bit about your personal opinion on which ones are good dry and which ones you would never purchase for your restaurant, for example?
Well, you know, when it comes to fresh pasta, everybody has – you're always looking for the touch, right? You're looking for that consistency, that texture, and definitely the palatability of, you know, that combination of egg and flour ultimately, right? You're looking for that perfect grind and texture and double zero flour or maybe single zero flour grind and things like that. There's certain things that you need to use – dry pasta for, like spaghetti aglio olio. You probably aren't going to use a fresh pasta for that. You're mostly going to have to use a dry pasta.
But
for
why
that.
Is that?
I think most of it's tradition. I also think that it's all about texture. It's also about the way it kind of coats the pasta itself. I never have a definitive answer on that. Honestly,
okay.
The only thing that I've come up with in my years of cooking. In speaking to Italians or being in Italy or whatever it is always that it's this is what we do, this is how we do it.
Okay,
so sometimes that's
so
enough.
So some falls on the side of tradition.
That's right.
And some of it is your interpretation as a chef and leader in the kitchen.
That's right.
What about al dente? I was recently at a restaurant, had some pasta. For some people at the table, perfection. For mm-hmm. some people at the table, they thought that it was undercooked.
Yeah.
So this goes back to the common restaurant problem, which is to some people, salt is too salty and other people need salt on the table. So for you, did you use timers in your restaurants to get the perfect al dente quality? Did you just simply show your chefs your cooks over and over and over until they nailed it the way you wanted it? Like, how do you, because pasta pickups are so hard. It's not like cooking pasta at home. You can't just watch a pot, keep taking noodles out and say, it's done for me. It's like you might be picking up, what, I don't know, 8-10 pastas at the same time.
Or more.
In different shapes with different cook times.
That's
so if you can talk a little bit about that, too.
Well, that's one of the challenges of working a pasta station. It's hard. Mm-hmm. It's always the most difficult station in the kitchen because it is so precise. And the expression is pasta waits for no one. And that's kind of the point. It needs to keep moving. Periodically, we'll use timers. The timers that I use mostly are to check the saline content of the water. That, obviously as that water flushes out and you're running a little bit of cold water to keep the level and it doesn't evaporate, sometimes it doesn't stay salty enough. So you need every 15 minutes we're checking the saline content of the water. But more for the pasta itself, that's something you got to work on. That's identifying that touch.
And so when you're saying identifying the saline content, are you talking about like an actual someone's taking a tasting spoon and tasting the water all by itself over the course of service? Someone's taking very small spoonfuls of water and saying, like, I got to tweak the levels of the salt.
Absolutely.
It's cool because, working hot and working pasta and, when you're manipulating meat over fire or you're cooking pasta, there's a lot of chemistry there. It doesn't really it just is cooking, but there's a lot of things at play. There's heat and there's, like you said, evaporation.
That's right.
So I'm curious, at your restaurants, is there a specific type of range or pot that you like? Is there a style of pots that you use for when you're cooking pasta? Do you have a big bath with pasta cookers that sit in the same bath? Like, how does that work?
So we have here at Fusco, what we did is there's a guy on the Bowery who takes he takes basically a wok burner and he puts it underneath this big vat that you fill up with water. Mm-hmm. And it's, of all the pasta cookers that I've used, whether they be from Italy or from the US or wherever they're from, these are the best. This guy has these huge burners that just fire up this water, and we keep that going. And he builds them. I mean, he does a great job at them, and they're relatively inexpensive considering.
So it's pretty much just like a gigantic single pot. It's almost like a sink, basically.
That's
and you can so then you're cooking all the various pastas in it using baskets.
We'll use about, I think there's 6 baskets inside that vat.
Cool.
Yeah.
And how many types of pasta are you doing now at Fusco?
At Fusco, we have 5 on the menu. We have a nudi, which is a lobster nudi. We have 2 different type of filled pastas. We have a spaghetti pomodoro, and we have a garganelli with a duck, with a braised lamb neck.
Yeah. You're obviously a pasta guy.
I do a lot of pasta.
You have been for a very long time. What is your favorite shape to make over the course of your career? Is there a certain pasta dish that really you feel like speaks to you, or does it change?
There's things. I mean, I dream about this stuff, believe it or not, and it sounds so cliche, but I really do. Some people dream of sex. I dream about pasta.
It's not a bad thing to dream about, honestly.
Yeah, I mean, it could be much worse. Yeah.
Yeah.
I had a dream the other night about a pork ragu with sea urchin and squid ink pasta. And I'm trying to figure out what this is. If it's a tomato-based ragu or if it's not. But the thought process was, if it's like a, I woke up tasting this thing, right? So it's kind of weird. But pork belly that's really nice and crisped, tossed with a squid ink pasta, and maybe there's some kind of tomato product inside that or not. A little bit of andouille also to add a backdrop of flavor, some more depth, and then finish with sea urchin also. So, chalatele, which is a milk-based pasta from Sorrento with squid ink inside of it. So it's about, it's about 3 inches long or so, kind of cut like a linguine, but a little bit more broad. I'm not sure if I'm answering the question, but as I'm thinking out loud, thinking about this thing, that's I'm like, I gotta make this. So that's going to be the next pasta that we're identifying.
The first time I ever ate squid ink pasta was at Scarpetta.
Oh, really?
I was a young cook and I just moved to New York, and my brother and I were celebrating something, and nice. We went to Scarpetta, and I had squid ink, and he ordered it, and I had never seen it on a menu before. And so that to me sticks out as like a very tangible food moment,
yeah,
in my New York City food sort of exploration. Here with Scott Connett. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to talk more about pasta. Stick with us.
This program is brought to you by Chefs Collaborative, a national nonprofit network with a mission to inspire, educate, and celebrate chefs and food professionals building a better food system. Chefs Collaborative members work to make sustainable practices second nature for every chef in the United States. Chefs Collaborative was founded in 1993 by visionary chefs including Rick Bayless and Alice Waters, who acknowledged the influential role of food professionals on our food choices, our collective personal health, the vitality of cultures, and the integrity of the global environment. Chefs Collaborative believes that the greater culinary community can be a catalyst for positive change by expanding the market for good food and helping to preserve local farming and fishing communities. Change menus, change lives. Learn more about Chefs Collaborative at chefscollaborative.org.
Hi, I'm Kimberly Chow.
And I'm Amanda Dell.
And we're the hosts of Recommended Reading with Food Book Fair on Heritage Radio Network. Recommended Reading is a show where we talk about what we're reading, listening to, and watching in the world of food media, between ourselves as well as with our special guests in and around the food world.
Support Recommended Reading and all of Heritage Radio Network's programming by going to heritageradionetwork.org and clicking on the beating heart, and you can become a member today.
Welcome back to The Line. I'm here with Scott Connett, and we're talking about some of his early career working in New York. I want to talk about 2013, when things really started to kind of coalesce and come together for your career in sort of a forward-facing way. You had been cooking for a long time, obviously, in New York, but in 2003, your pasta was on the cover of Food & Wine, you were on the cover of Gourmet, and then in 2004, you were named Best New Chef by Food & Wine. So from then, you've basically been a very recognizable chef, and from then you've gone on to do quite a bit of TV. I want to know, what did it feel like when you started to get really recognized? Being in the back kitchen for so many years, and I assume your guests obviously knew who you were, but at that point, you're probably gaining a certain amount of notoriety nationally. Do you remember what that moment was like for you?
Yeah, I had an ex-girlfriend come into L'Impero at the time, and she was like, you know, you're like turning into a celebrity. And I was, I mean, honestly, I don't view myself that way. I'm a cook, you know. I still spend time in the kitchens where I'm most comfortable. But I felt the switch. You know, that's when things, to your point, the popcorn started to pop at that point.
Did you get pushback from people in the industry? Were there people that were either in your restaurants or people that you had known for years that they maybe weren't so happy that this was happening for you?
Of course. There's always haters. I mean, there's always going to be haters. You know, there's people now that I'm a really grounded guy. I don't get too wrapped up in stuff. If people see me and they recognize me from a TV show on the street and they want to take a picture, I'm appreciative. There's a lot of gratitude on my side. I've struggled a lot in my career, even since 2003. So I realized that there's a balance. There's always ups and downs. And the only thing that we can maintain is our attitude towards it. right? That's my biggest. I'll walk with that stick for the rest of my life. But there's going to be haters, and there's people now that were really good friends back in the day that are just turned off by the idea of television. Television is a very weird thing, and people's reactions towards it, it's just strange.
Yeah, I am curious about, do you have a sort of inner dialogue? Because you just said, you know, I'm a cook. I still spend a lot of time in the kitchen. You have several restaurants, and I definitely want to talk about the aspect of you managing several locations in different cities. But how do you feel about the fact that you're better known now for being on TV than you are for, you know, your earlier career, to especially to young people that are only turning on the TV and have never experienced your restaurants in New York? How does that make you feel?
It's strange because like you said, I've been doing this for almost 32 years now. Mm-hmm. It's been a long, I can't believe I could say that, but I'm getting old, man. So, it's frustrating when I get somebody who on social media and they want to talk smack about, you don't even compete, you know, you don't want to do Iron Chef. I'm sorry, that wasn't the motivation back in the day. Back in the day, when I was coming up, none of this stuff existed.
Yeah.
That's not, I'm sorry, but being an Iron Chef is not interesting to me. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Like, I don't know if we could curse. I'm not going to curse.
Yeah, you can say whatever you want.
Fuck that. Seriously. I can imagine no worse every day waking up having to compete on those shows. Like, I first of all, I hate to lose. Right. And the sting of losing is far worse than the thrill of winning for me. So I will not put myself in that situation. Like, I just won't do it.
so let me just take it one step further and ask you, like, as someone who's done, I don't know, 30 some seasons of Chopped and you're on TV all the time, do you feel like these shows are a detriment to professional cooks, or do they help them?
I go back and forth with this a lot, but always I think these shows are beneficial in the sense that they're realistic, right? Everybody has a story, right? It makes the TV great, the drama, but we judge food and food only, and there's no getting around that. People, of course, inevitably, they want to take issue with some of our decisions. There's three people who taste that food, three, and they're sitting at the judge's table. It could look beautiful and it can taste horrible. It could also look horrible and taste beautiful. You never know what you're going to get sometimes, and you're never going to be able to experience that unless you're tasting it. And I'm sorry, but when you're on the other side of the TV, you just don't get it. It just doesn't exist.
I want to know about the restaurant projects that you have. Over the years, you've expanded pretty rapidly, I would say, from an outward perspective. And now you've got several locations across the United States. How many active restaurants do you have right now?
Right now, I think I'm at five. I'm shedding a couple.
Okay.
I'm shedding the things that make less sense for me.
I mean, okay.
It's funny the way life works, because you want these things, right? And then all of a sudden you put yourself in a situation, you get it, and it's like, oof, I'm doing it with the wrong people, or this isn't the right fit, or what I really want to do, I can't do. So, you know, I hate signing a deal to sign a deal. I have infrastructure. I have bills to pay. I have a team that I have to make sure gets their salary on a weekly basis. I'm a business person as well, and I'm learning as I'm going. To your earlier point, I don't necessarily have that one person that I could sit with and get the advice from. I've learned my business practice through trial and error.
So that means that pretty much you're the sort of CEO, CFO of your sprawling operation to a certain extent, or do you have a counterpart within this organization?
I don't have a counterpart. I have a team.
Okay.
And I like to, I don't treat anybody like I'm their boss. That's not my management style. I'm a believer that if you're hired into this company, you're an adult. You should be able to manage yourself. And I hire you for your expertise. Mm-hmm. In what I'm hiring you for. And I give a tremendous amount of leeway until there's a problem. and we go through things, and I'm a big communicator. I insist on being communicated to. That's really the only thing I insist on. I want to know what everybody's doing. And everybody has this, it's a very clear vision of the goal. The goal is to make people happy. And this is what we're going to do to make people happy. This is the vision of the restaurant. We need to work within the confines of this vision.
How do you actually execute a restaurant that, if it's in a hotel or if it's not in your home city, you live in Arizona now and you're opening up a restaurant in New York. I'm curious, how does that process work? Do you craft the menu, train staff, and then sort of turn over the keys to a CDC and say, I'll be back, and you know, you're in charge? Like, who has creative control, and also who is sort of your eyes and ears on the ground besides the CDC in the kitchen?
So I have a corporate chef also.
Okay.
And we together with the executive chef of the restaurant. So I, you know, my title would be chef owner or, mm-hmm. or is, sometimes it's executive chef. It doesn't matter. I still have to have an executive chef of the restaurant. I'm not going to pretend that I walk into a restaurant and, you know, I boss everybody around and then I turn around and walk out. That chef, it's a very difficult balance for that chef to work under another chef, right? And I'm not going to pretend that that's not difficult for that person. And it wouldn't make sense for me to kind of push my weight around and devalue that individual's prowess, right? I mean, it wouldn't make any sense. And I think it would be undermining for that individual. So I think they appreciate being respected because I would appreciate being respected. I wouldn't want to work for somebody who was a dick and just walked in and started telling everybody what to do. My corporate chef with me and that chef of the restaurant will go through that initial menu. I'll have a few things. I kind of sit in a space and meditate what that experience should be like and what I would expect to eat or what I would want to eat inside this venue. And it's funny how it comes. It's funny how, you know, I'll sit and just be like spaghetti with sea urchin and ramps, or, you know, I don't know, or breadcrumbs or something like that. And that'll be the starting point of the menu. So that's where I start from. And then I try to get the team on board with that vision.
So is a normal, I assume you don't have a normal day, but like when you're on the ground at one of your restaurants, how much is it of you just looking, and then do you give notes back to like the GM and the executive chef, or do you actually come out and say things? Like, I guess what I'm asking is, there's sort of like this fine line where like you're obviously in charge, but like yeah. you said, you don't want to usurp their authority and mm-hmm. chop their legs out from underneath them. But I imagine that you walk around and see things that you don't like
yeah.
and see things that you want to change. So what is the process for making tweaks, making changes?
It should always come from the chef of that restaurant. It shouldn't come from me. And it's not that I don't spend time speaking to the team, because I want to make sure that the team realizes that I'm not just some figure, you know what I mean? This fictitious person who flies in or, you know, it's, first of all, I don't hire fans, right? I think that's weird. You know, I don't want people to be a fan of me and then because inevitably I'm going to disappoint them if that's the case. It's because I'm not easy to work with. I'm tough and I'm demanding and I'm a perfectionist and I want things to be right. And if somebody's a fan, they're not going to understand where that, like, it's not that I'm angry. It's that I'm pointed. And sometimes there's no niceties there, you know? It's just like, why is it like this? So I don't want to hire those people. I want people, and that's why it has to come from the chef also. So I'll pull the chef aside and be like, I saw this, 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 and this. And when I say that, I'll say, when you get a chance, fix it. And they all come to understand that doesn't mean when you get a chance. That means do it right now. So I say it to be nice. What I really mean, like, fucking get it done mm-hmm. because I don't like this shit.
And so what are your greatest challenges with having multiple locations? So you've got places in various hotels mm-hmm. and casinos. These are like really large scale projects. Yeah. They're not you opened up a 25 seat restaurant and you're, you know, able to interact with every customer. These are like really high volume, really high profile locations. So how do you organize the infrastructure of your company beyond the executive chef with kind of you at the top? Like, yeah. How did you grow into basically having to have a full team? One yeah. day, did you go from one to two, or, you know, how do you figure that out?
Well, yeah, I went from one to two, and then I sold my shares of that group, and I started the next group, and that's when we started Scarpetta, and now, obviously, on to the next one. So it started with, you know, I do a lot of stuff. I do a lot of things between, and it's futile to go through the list of revenue streams that I'm trying to create for myself. But it's important to note that I do too many things to do one thing well, right? So that's why I need a team of people to do it for me. So I could come up with ideas, but then they have to execute, right? So, you know, that means I need an operations person. And I need a corporate chef. So I need someone to help me with that creative side as well. So the corporate chef also oversees the back of house finances. I also have a corporate controller to make sure that all the, so that my corporate controller, my director of restaurants, and my corporate chef are all underneath me. I also have someone who does all my events and marketing. I have a personal assistant. And then I have chefs who help me with different events when I have to travel and do. I'm not going to show up to an event in Mexico and start cooking. Like my days are too difficult. I can't do that stuff anymore. I wish I could. I wish I could just shut off the phone and not worry about it. But I own too many restaurants. I own too many businesses. I have too many things that I have to do. I'm on too many deadlines, so to speak. And I'm not saying that to sound like that guy. I mean, it's just the reality of my situation. When I'm not Tom Colicchio, but my days are probably very similar to Tom's. You know what I mean? And mm-hmm. that's, you know, when I think of the top of the totem pole, you know, those guys like Thomas Keller and JG and Eric Reparin and Danielle, my days probably aren't that different from those guys. I need to figure out how to create that money stream.
And so as you continue to try to move forward and you are expanding, I want to know about Fusco. Why return to New York? You're talking about how difficult your day-to-day management is. There's a lot of moving pieces. You're very candid about the fact that you can't be everywhere at the same yeah. time and you need help. Like, okay, so you've pulled back the curtain on the fact that you're not everywhere and that you can't cook every plate of pasta. So when you come back to New York and why do you come back to such a difficult city after how long has it been since you've been here with your own individual project?
With a freestanding project, we opened Scarpetta in 2008. So it's been 9 years, mm-hmm. 9 years, last independent restaurant here. So, you know, we're all gluttons for punishment, I guess, but I'll tell you that the passion is the driver and that's the motivator. And, I really truly feel like Fusco is such a unique space. It used to be Veritas. It's kind of hallowed ground to a certain extent for a lot of people. So many regular customers still come into Fusco now just because they loved Veritas so much. And I love this, man. I love this. I love spending time in restaurants. I love cooking. I love teaching. I love coaching. I love spending time with the client base and nurturing not just the team and the service staff, but also the customers and the food, and really just having that point of view, that brand beacon, so to speak, that one signature restaurant that I could always go back to and be like, everything is great, right? All these restaurants are wonderful. We're moving forward in a lot of different venues, but I need the one place to be able to hang my hat at all times, and that's what Fusco is.
I want to talk a little bit about your family. You've moved recently to Arizona. Mm-hmm. And I assume for many, many years you were trying to find that balance between being in the kitchen and your business. How does it feel to be both simultaneously opening this new place that you can hang your hat on, but also Are you reaching a point where you're thinking of slowing down at all?
I'm too young to slow down. I'll tell you, the happiest I ever am is when I'm just spending time with my family, right? I mean, that's, you know, I have two little girls, 7 and 4, and that is the core. That's the most important thing in my world. And you got to work, you got to make a living. I like to think that I have a pretty tremendous work ethic. I love to work also. And so ultimately, as an entrepreneur, it's the most selfish thing that I can do is to continue to work the way I work, because I first of all, I love it. Second of all, I'm creating it for myself, right? It wasn't necessarily in the cards in 1985 when I started working at the Sea Loft. It wasn't in the cards back then. This, what chefs are doing today, didn't exist, right? This station didn't exist back then, right? The Food Network didn't exist back then. There was no such thing as restaurants or chefs owning more than one restaurant. Like, just didn't exist. So I feel like I'm in a very fortunate time. And I feel like a lot of chefs are taking advantage of that.
When you're back in New York, I'm curious about where you're liking to eat besides your restaurants. What's inspiring you? I don't really want to hear about, like, you know, we can glaze over like food trends, but I'm curious, like, what are some places that to you epitomize New York dining? And then if there's anywhere new that's really like jumped out at you on your radar.
This is really pathetic. But I work way too much. I really do. I'm in Fusco every single night when I'm in New York. So, I'm not eating out, unfortunately. But I'm also an old school guy. I go to Jean Georges for lunch every chance I get. I think it's the best lunch deal in Manhattan. When you walk in there and you get three courses for $40 or whatever it is at a 4-star, and truly have a 4-star experience, right? I like fancy restaurants, so I'm gonna, you know, I like to go to those things. There's been many times in my career where I've literally spent my last dollar. Back in the day when Grey Kuntz was at L'Espanasse, I'd literally spent my last dollar there multiple times, or maxed out the credit card at dinner.
So what is it for you about the experience of going to that style of restaurant? Because, you know, some chefs like to go to Chinatown and get a $5 plate of something. For you, you're looking for that kind of high-end experience. You were when you were younger, when you couldn't afford it, and you still are now. Can you speak about what about that, you know, either motivates you or makes you feel good?
I think there's an aspirational aspect to it that is exciting for me. I love luxury. I just do. I don't know why. My mother said, when I was a kid, I remember saying to me, you have a champagne taste and a Budweiser budget. She would always tell me. But, you know, there's a word in Turkish called kef, right? My wife is Turkish. So, and it's that moment where you just kind of exhale, that relaxation comes in. And when I go to restaurants that I really love to experience, they don't necessarily even have to be super fancy restaurants, but it seems to happen more often because they have their shit together, right? So that moment of just so relaxing. I love that.
Your wife is Turkish. You said that before we went on air, you said that your kids are going to go spend some time with their grandmother in Turkey, right? For over the summer. Has any of that crept into your cooking at all? Does your wife cook at home? Are those flavors that you use either in or outside of your restaurants? Has it influenced your style in any way?
It's and different things. I if I do a Mediterranean aspect of a restaurant, if I do a restaurant I've opened a lot of restaurants. I've also closed a lot of restaurants. So one of the restaurants that I closed had a Mediterranean accent to it. I'll do things like that when it calls for it. Yeah, absolutely. We've spent so much time in Turkey over the years. I got married there. It's become part of my life. And my wife is a hell of a cook. She does that Turkish food really well. Yeah.
Since you just brought it up, I have to ask, what does it feel like to close a restaurant?
Oh, it sucks, man. I'm closing one today, as a matter of fact.
What are you doing?
DOCG in Vegas is closing. It sucks. First of all, you think of all the things you could have done differently to make it work. You think about how many people you've employed and how this is going to affect their life. So, you try to place them and make their life better. It's sad, and I'm not one of those people who fall in love with brick and mortar. I'm a feelings guy, right? I'm an energies guy, and when energies are off, things fall to the wayside, and I think that's one of the reasons what's happened to DOCG, and it's disappointing, and I'm disappointed in myself because I want to be Jesus. I want to fix shit. I want everybody. I want to save everybody.
So as you open up a place and close another place, and you're still a young guy, but you're kind of reflecting on what has happened over the course of your career, is there something that you look back and is there a pivotal moment in which you wish you could have changed something? Are you a reflections guy or are you a forward facing?
I'm always forward facing, but I think you can learn from your mistakes. I think it's important to put yourself in a situation to pursue betterment. I think it's about tweaking things, right? If I were to do it again, if I were to do it all again, I'd have better lawyers. That's all I'll say about that.
Scott, we're gonna end on that. For all you wannabe business owners out there, heed some advice from Scott. He says, get a good lawyer. I appreciate you joining me today on the line. Tell everybody where they can find your new restaurant in New York City.
Fusco, 43 East 20th Street.
We appreciate you joining us today, and hopefully we'll have you back on again to talk about new restaurants and hopefully no future closures.
God willing.
Join us every week here on Heritage Radio for a new episode of The Line, Tuesdays at 11 a.m.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.